Hello there, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Good Sentences, your soon-to-be favorite podcast, if it isn't already.
Should be.
Although, to be honest, Scott, I am a little surprised we've made it this far. What is this, episode nine?
Nine.
Eight?
I think nine? It's nine, yeah.
I mean, one more, and that's as far as I can count, so we're almost to the run of the podcast, I think.
Yeah, I think this is going to be it, unless we, like, let me do the accounting for the next 10.
I haven't counted on all the fingers. I haven't counted on the toes yet.
Right. So we could go as high as 40.
Really. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're good.
Except
we're good.
For that unfortunate lawnmower accident, 39.
Well, I don't think the FCC is going to let us go much beyond that anyway.
You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
I had a really good time last month talking about character development, all things character related. And we actually even had guest J.A. Jantz, the New York Times bestselling author, come on and talk about her experiences with creating some of her major well-known characters. And that was a great time to talk to her as well. So thank you to her for coming on the show, because you know I'm sure she's listening, right?
Oh, yeah. I think she subscribed the minute she got the...
Craig and Scott. What? Sign me up, she said. I'm pretty sure those were her exact words.
I think that was even the tone she used when she said it. Slightly lilting, a little bit, I don't know, starry-eyed maybe?
But yeah, so I had a really good time talking about that. And character is one of those things where I feel like the deeper we delved down into it, the more there was to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like a self-renewing well. But, you know, at some point, you've got to move on and talk about other things, because writing is also one of those things where the more you talk about it, just the craft of, the broader the subject becomes.
Right.
Writing is one of those pursuits that is lifelong. Like, you never get to a point, much like music, for example.
Right. Right.
Back in the day, I was a pianist. And
that's a word you want to make sure to enunciate, by the way.
Pianist. Yes.
You were what now?
Well, it was my duty as a pianist. How I combine those two.
No, I'm totally done. I'm done. I'm going to mute my mic. You go on without me, because it's just going to be laughter on this side for the next 10 minutes.
Well, I got to tell you, it seems, and this is some sort of conspiracy, but, and Scott knows that one of my day jobs is as an audiobook narrator. And I got to tell you, I have never seen the word duty pop up as much in audiobooks as I have the last couple weeks since we did that show.
Right.
I see it everywhere now. And that, so I don't know how many times I've had to stop the recording. It's all because of you.
You should leave that in just one time, you know, like an Easter egg, you know, just duty, and then go quiet for a second and then go, well, duty.
I look forward to the day when I've made so much money at it that I can afford to do that.
That you can just tank someone's platform.
Here, I destroyed your project, so here's 10 grand. Yeah, right. I know I ruined it for you, but it was worth it. It was worth it.
I got to tell you, I started drinking on page one. By the time I got to page, I don't know, three?
I have no idea what the hell we were talking about.
Were we doing a show today, maybe? Oh, I remember we were. We had talked about character, and now we were going to move on to a new topic.
Right, because, yeah, mining or writing is one of those things, kind of like in music. There we go. But, in music, the piano is one of those things where the saying is, it's easy to learn but impossible to master,
right?
Kind of those things. And writing is kind of the same way. Easy to get into it, but it's a lifelong pursuit in terms of mastering. I don't know that there are some people who have gotten as close as anybody, but I don't know if it's one of those things where you never quite reach the the pinnacle. Moving on, one of our goals here on the show is to get all of us as close to that as possible, because mm-hmm. if you're a writer, then if you're a real writer, and I hate when people say real writer, but I think this carries through. If you are one, then you want to be the best one you can be.
Right.
It's one of those things that kind of drives you onward. You have those inner demons, you know, driving you to do this. It's something that you need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're a writer, you have to write.
When I go to various events, almost invariably, it seems like somebody asks, you know, thinking about writing, should I be a writer? And kind of the cynical part of me is like, if you have to ask the question,
you've already answered it.
Then the answer may be no.
Right.
If you're asking whether or not you should pursue this as a living, that's a legitimate question.
Right. And, and the answer is, of course,
right,
no.
Of course not. Are you crazy?
Try your luck on Broadway, dude. You're going to do better.
Tap dancing would be a better pursuit, I think. So moving on from character last month in January to the great month of February, where we'll be talking, at least today, topic is dialogue. It's difficult for me when I think about the different aspects of writing to decide which one is the most important. But dialogue's right up there.
Right.
It can be the lifeblood of your piece, or it can be...
just blood everywhere.
Blood everywhere.
It was horrible.
That's usually everywhere. What's all over my keyboard at the end of a first draft, right? But this is going to be a great show because I can't keep on topic to save my life. I'm also bursting at the seams with profanity, so I just can't just stifle one there.
It'll be fine.
It's the booze.
I was actually waiting to start recording to, like, uncork my beer and do it right up next to the mic. And I was going to say, now it's a podcast. But, I mean, that would have made me wait another 30 seconds before I started drinking. So,
yeah. But, you know, it's funny. I did think the other day that we ought to have a drink of the week or whatever, and we drink that during the show.
Oh,
and then
like
we talk about it. I think that's kind of a, hey, what are you drinking tonight, Scott, kind of thing. I mean,
right,
we don't really need another excuse to drink, but it'd be nice to have one.
Now, I see us recording a lot more episodes if we decide to do that.
Suddenly our productivity goes through the roof.
You guys record an episode every day last week? No, we did three every day last week.
5 o'clock everywhere at all times.
And I remember the first one vividly. After that, it's all a little blurry.
But I'm sure they were great. But no, dialogue is one of those things where the more you put into it, the more you're going to get out of it. It's an ongoing, like writing itself, it's an ongoing effort. And the harder you work at it, the better your results are going to be. And I did have a couple of examples of great dialogue, and I think Scott has a couple as well.
Coincidentally, I do.
Coincidentally, I know. It's almost like we're on the same podcast and talked about it beforehand. One of mine is from Hemingway. Of course, you know, one of us had to pull a Hemingway out, right? I am unapologetically a Hemingway fanboy, so deal with it.
Deal, yeah.
That's what you're going to get from me, at least. This is in the story, Hills Like White Elephants. Two people, a man and a woman, they're talking at a bar, and it gradually becomes obvious that they're talking about the woman being pregnant and possibly having an abortion. I recorded this bit earlier, and here we go.
"The beer is nice and cool," the man said. "It's lovely," the girl said. "It's really an awfully simple operation, Jig," the man said. "It's not really an operation at all." The girl looked at the ground the table legs rested on. "I know you wouldn't mind it, Jig. It's really not anything. It's just to let the air in." The girl did not say anything. "I'll go with you, and I'll stay with you all the time. They just let the air in, and then it's all perfectly natural."
"Then what will we do afterward?"
"We'll be fine afterward, just like we were before."
"What makes you think so?"
"That's the only thing that bothers us. It's the only thing that's made us unhappy."
So that's that little bit, and you kind of see through the, you know, as I was reading through how Hemingway sets up the rhythm, the man
right.
said, the girl said, the man said, and then from then on, it's nothing,
right.
no tags.
No tags at all.
And it doesn't need it.
Right.
And that's, I think, key to where, unless you're using the tag for an effect,
mm-hmm.
which you've got to be careful with,
right.
But unless you're doing that, if you can find a way to create dialogue that doesn't need the ongoing said, then the better.
Right.
Because it shows, I mean, first of all, it's a lot more work, mm-hmm. which I think is why a lot of people don't do it, to find creative way. And I don't, not saying like tie yourself in knots to avoid it. I'm
right.
not talking about that because it can just get weird, obvious, and awkward. But if you can find creative ways to show what you're talking about and who's talking, then a lot of times that's a lot better than using those tags. I was reading a book by a really well-known author. I'm not sure if I should even say his name. And it's not the one you're thinking of. But it was, I'll just say it. It's Robert B. Parker.
Oh, my God, you said the name.
And I regret everything. there was so much. And I was listening to it in audio, which made it even worse because my mind, my subconscious, and I couldn't, like, turn it off. And it was like, he said. And it was like, oh, my God. Like, it was bringing, it wasn't like, you know, Hemingway sometimes does that. Here we go with Hemingway again.
Right.
But he sometimes does that to great effect to make a point and as a part of his craft.
Yep.
This was not that.
Right.
This was just, in my view, lazy writing.
Right.
And I was like, are you kidding me? This guy has sold millions of books.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, what is happening here? So that's the kind of stuff. Now, he could get away with it because he has sold that many books.
Right.
And so he could do whatever the hell he wants.
Right.
But the point is, too, that we are not Robert B. Parker.
Right.
And so it would behoove us to put a lot more effort into our dialogue tags.
At least till the first million books get sold, then.
Right. After that, I mean, whatever. And after that, you can hire other people to write for you and just put your name on the book, right?
Not that we know anyone who does that.
Of course. I'm just saying, like, hypothetically speaking.
Yeah. That reminds me of a tweet that I did a couple months ago. It said, once I found out literary agents only read the first 5 pages, writing became a lot easier from page 6 on.
Right. So I have one other. Actually, why don't you go ahead and share one of your examples, and then we'll tag team.
Okay. This one actually, oddly enough, is a Hemingway also, but it really reinforces that thing we were just talking about with the tags. And I'm just going to read it, and then I'll point out what I mean if you don't pick it up on your own, which you're all very brilliant people, so you will. This is from The Sun Also Rises. Dialogue being used to establish divergent characters, very divergent in this case, Robert Cohen, former middleweight champion at Yale? I don't remember, someplace. And, of course, Jake Barnes, my all-time favorite character in all of literature, I think. It starts out with Cohen saying, this is a good place, he said. There's a lot of liquor, I agreed. Listen, Jake. He leaned forward on the bar. Don't you ever get the feeling that all your life is going by and you're not taking advantage of it? You realize you've lived nearly half the time you have to live already? Yes, every once in a while. Do you know that in about 35 years more, we'll be dead? What the hell, Robert? I said. What the hell? I'm serious. It's one thing I don't worry about, I said. You ought to. I've had plenty to worry about one time or another. I'm through worrying. Well, I want to go to South America. Listen, Robert, going to another country doesn't make any difference. I've tried all that. You can't get away from yourself by moving from one place to another. There's nothing to that. But you've never been to South America. South America, hell. If you went there the way you feel now, it would be exactly the same. This is a good town. Why don't you start living your life in Paris? I'm sick of Paris, and I'm sick of the Quarter. Stay away from the Quarter. Cruise around by yourself and see what happens to you. Nothing happens to me. I walked alone all one night and nothing happened except a bicycle cop stopped me and asked to see my papers. Wasn't the town nice at night? I don't care for Paris. So,
this is so good.
With almost zero tags and with absolutely no adverbs, which is another thing we'll jump on, you can hear the adverb, you can hear the tag. And I mean, if it had been me, and I've mentioned before with Craig that probably my favorite line in all of literature is, what the hell, Robert? I said, what the hell? And from the moment I read that when I was 16 or 17, I just glommed onto it. Transcendental. I knew immediately that I had read one of the best lines ever written. And the reason was that from the line that Jake has right before that, yes, every once in a while, to that line, without him telling us anything, we hear the change in our mind's ear. We can hear Jake just befuddled. What the hell, Robert? You know? And I love that. I love how he does that. And I strive to do the same. But man, I'm miles away from that level of just pared down to nothing and giving you everything.
This just encapsulates Hemingway's writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's what that was the genius of it. We're so simple and yet not at all.
Right.
He could say everything he needed to say in the simplest sentences. And, you know, it's amazing now, but especially back in the day when coming off of what was the popular, flowery Victorian type writing. And then, you know, there was a little bit of evolution there prior, but then suddenly Hemingway comes along and boom, it's like, whoa.
Yep.
What is this? It was something totally new. Amazing then, but still incredible now. And I, you know, there are a lot of writers, popular ones out there, who could use a little paring down.
A little paring down. Yep. But and I guess the other thing for me about Hemingway is, you know, the pure masculinity of his style.
I feel unapologetic.
I feel like every Hemingway book cover should have stubble.
Right. A little BO.
Yeah. You know, maybe a black eye.
And unapologetically so, but at the same time, especially the more you read about Hemingway the man.
Right. Right.
You begin to really get insight into his writing as well. And it is masculine and it can be in your face at times, but at the same time, there is an odd tenderness.
Mm-hmm. I was going to use the word sensitivity.
Sensitivity underneath. That was just that mask. And mm-hmm. that is Hemingway as well. He presented this brash image, and he was a lot of the things that people call him when they're trying to insult him, but he was so much more than that. And that's what people often miss about Hemingway, the man, like his generosity, for example, mm-hmm. the extent to which he suffered from prior marriages. The ending of his first marriage was something he didn't get over it, and he never forgave himself for it. So, I mean, when you get into the psychology of Hemingway, you not only begin to understand him better, of course, but you also begin to understand his writing a little bit more as well. And I think I wish a lot of people prior to criticizing Hemingway blindly would do a little research. I think it would do everybody a lot of good. I guess my next example is from John Steinbeck from Of Mice and Men, Roll Tape. Is this a roll tape? What is this, 1973?
I forgot, Lenny said softly. I tried not to forget. Honest to God, I did, George. Okay, I'll tell you again. I ain't got nothing to do. Might just as well spend all my time telling you things, and then you forget them, and I tell you again. Tried and tried, said Lenny, but it didn't do no good. I remember about the rabbits, George. The hell with the rabbits. That's all you ever can remember is in rabbits. Okay, now you listen, and this time you gotta remember so we don't get in no trouble. You remember sitting in that gutter on Howard Street and watching that blackboard? Lenny's face broke into a delighted smile.
Why, sure, George, I remember that, but what'd we do then?
I remember some girls come by, and you say,
the hell with what I says. You remember about us going into Murray and Reddy's, and they give us work cards and bus tickets?
Oh, sure, George, I remember that now.
His hands went quickly into his side coat pockets. He said gently,
George, I ain't got mine. I must have lost it.
He looked down at the ground in despair.
You never had none, you crazy bastard. I got both of them here. Think I'd let you carry your own work card?
Lenny grinned with relief. So there's another example of really limited tags. Like there are a couple in there. Like Lenny said softly, and there's an adverb there, which we'll talk about in a minute, as Scott mentioned earlier. But other than that, let's make it clear, it's always obvious who's doing the speaking.
Right.
That is key in dialogue. You want to do that above all.
And that's even without Craig's dynamic voiceover skills.
Especially without
it. Your mind's ear should be hearing something similar, although probably not as testosterone-laced as Craig's rendering.
Well, anyway, going forward, I got it today.
But it's like, you know, after, you know, Lenny said softly, then we've got like no tag because here's the thing. If you've only got two people in a scene and one of them just spoke, the next dialogue line is obviously the other person, unless he's got a mouse in his pocket, right?
Right.
So you don't need anything there. Then Lenny back to Lenny, he could probably have left that one out, to be honest with you.
Right.
And then back to George and so on and so forth. And then here's one where we don't have a tag, but we have Lenny's face broken to a delighted smile. That is the tag.
Yes.
That serves as the tag, but it's presented in a different creative way that lends something to the scene. So it's a stylistic choice, but it also serves a purpose. And so, and that is also a sign of an accomplished writer when they can do that as well.
I would just like to add a little footnote here that when Craig and I were first discussing the examples that we were going to bring forth, and he told me that he had picked this particular Steinbeck, I thanked him profusely because I was going to pick the very same one, but there were a bunch of boxes in front of it. And I decided it was too much work to pull that out. And then you had picked that, and I'm like, problem solved.
Well, that's the closest book to me.
I wonder how much dialogue there is in this here Merriam-Webster collegiate dictionary.
I can reach this one without turning my torso.
But well, I think, you know, one of the things that I see a lot of writers, particularly new writers, and I'm not trying to dump on new writers, but it's just it's one of the things that happens. They often employ exotic tags to spice up their writing.
Right.
And that does kind of make sense on a certain level, because a lot of those same writers were probably in a creative writing class at one point, high school, college, whatever, and just were told to avoid word repetition, use vocabulary. And so they use stuff like interjected, exclaimed, guffawed, or my favorite, ejaculated. Yet this sort of misses the point, though, when it comes to dialogue tags, because those tags are not supposed to be the center of attention.
Right.
You know, their function is to provide clarity in regards to the speaker. I don't know of anybody who has read a story and then marveled at how creative the dialogue tags were.
Yeah, really.
Right? I mean, if they're paying that close of attention to the dialogue tags, then something's going wrong. So in my view, anything that distracts from the story you're trying to tell should probably be cut out. This isn't to say that you can never use any tag but a simple said. I'm just saying that be judicious, you know, make good choices and handle those tags with care and make sure that they're taking a back seat to other devices. Like if you can use another method like we saw in the Steinbeck bit, right, then you're probably going to be better off.
I mean, I guess my feeling is if the third time you go to the thesaurus for another way of saying he said, right, maybe just leave the tag off at that point.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it was King who went even a step further. And said, you have to look up a word in a thesaurus. It's probably not the right one.
Right.
Which I don't know if I totally agree with that. So, but the point he's making is a good one.
In my experience, and I'm thinking about the fantasy series right now, I hit the beer hard and fast.
See, we should have been drinking more.
I hit the thesaurus often because not so much for things like tags, but for a theme in this section that I referred back to repeatedly, I needed different words for it. You know,
right.
The scene I'm thinking about is in the first book when Slur fights the champion of Burundi, you know, for a big bet to get them the money they need to go where they're going.
Right.
And, you know, you can only say fight so many times.
Right.
You know? So yeah, I went to a couple of you know, variations on that. But again, when we're talking about tags, if you got to find all those words for it, you probably would be just as well to just leave them out altogether, you know, after a while. And I mean, again, like you said, in moderation, no problem. In fact, perhaps in moderation, it could be used very effectively, as you've also said, but so easy to overdo.
Yeah. And another, we touched on this earlier, I believe you did, was that another quote by Stephen King is that the road to hell is paved with adverbs.
Yes.
You know, the pitfall in writing dialogue sometimes is the tendency to use those adverbs to modify the tag, like he said angrily or she said loudly or something like that.
Right.
And one reason I think people do this is that it's a lot easier to write that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier just to use the adverb than to go through all the trouble of creating, you know, another whole part of the scene to say what you meant to say.
Right.
But it can be so much more effective that way. I'm not saying you have to do it every time, but it's something to look out for. You know, it's the same reason I think writers often tell instead of show. It's just easier.
Right, right.
And as humans, and most writers are human,
we are. So far, we still have the
I don't want to name any names. Yes. We're programmed to, you know, to seek that shortest route to a predetermined goal. A lot of times when I've seen it, it's obvious that it was just lazy writing, you know, and learning how to handle those elements well can go a long way toward setting your work apart from the pack. And that's kind of one of the things that we want to do here on this show is
absolutely
help people, and Scott, and I'm including myself in this as well, to help us not just be as good as everybody else, because there are a lot of people out there trying to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The point is to be better and right. to investigate the craft in such a way and to learn it to such an extent that it sets our work apart from the crowd. And that's the only way that you're going to get noticed as a writer, because there are just so many voices going on with, you know, people putting their stuff up on social media and, right. and people, everybody's yelling for attention. But the way you're going to get that attention is just by being a bit better.
And speaking of someone who's a bit better, one of my favorite writers of the last 20, 25 years is a guy named Wally Lamb. My example here is from his book, I Know This Much Is True, which I think is my favorite of all of his works. In this example, again, we are learning about the nature of the characters, much as we did with the Hemingway example. But he takes it in a different and obviously a little bit more modern direction, because we're looking at, you know, the 1920s when we're talking about Hemingway. This book was written in the 80s, and the scene that I'm going to be reading from takes place during the Vietnam War. We're going to learn the nature of this character, Leo, from his interactions with others. He's eavesdropping on a pair of men described as a tall, skinny doofus and the other a squat fire hydrant with eyes. And he says to his friend, who is the narrator, just what we needed, Leo mumbled as we sat down, Popeye and Bluto blocking our view. Call her, the skinny one kept goading his no-neck friend. Which one? The one I was talking to at the bar. Should I? Hell yeah, go for it, man. Her name's Cindy. No Neck picked up the phone and dialed. Hello, Cindy? You don't know me, but I got a message for you from Dick Hertz. He cupped his hand over the receiver and winced in his effort not to laugh. Who's Dick Hertz? Well, now that you mention it, Cindy, mine's killing me. Care to give it some relief? He slammed down the receiver. Their loud guffawing and table whacking made half the people in the place look over in our direction. Jesus Christ, Birdsey. These guys make you look suave, Leo said. No wonder we're losing the fucking war. No Neck's buddy stared over at us for a couple of seconds, then leaned forward and tapped Leo on the shoulder. Excuse me, pal, but what'd you just say? Huh? Leo said. I asked you what you just said to your friend here. Something about my buddy and me and the fucking war? Leo looked bewildered. Then he laughed. Fucking whores is what I said. I said this place is full of fucking whores. Oh, well, he looked over at his buddy and back again. You got that right. I thought you said something else. No problem, my man, Leo said, flashing him the peace sign. I shook my head and smiled. Now, if you don't love that dialogue, you know, you don't love dialogue.
Right. I mean, yeah, there is so much. That passage is basically a masterclass in how to do dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got pretty much everything in it. It's got character development within dialogue, which is something we didn't even really touch on. It's got, you know, the judicious use of tags. It's got alternatives to tags that he uses masterfully. It's a perfect piece. So yes, I mean, dialogue is one of those things that is often overlooked, and, you know, people tend to go to the sexier things like perhaps character or plot development. That's always a popular one, and I'm sure we'll talk about that on a future podcast because it is important.
Right.
But dialogue, in my view, is just as important, and it is one of those things that can make your work stand out from the crowd and give it that kind of that shine, you know, that sparkle, that little touch of class.
Or conversely, it can make it stand out from the crowd because it just sucks so bad.
Right.
And that's what we're hoping to avoid here.
Exactly.
I've told Craig this story before privately, but until not too long ago, I was a member of a local writers group, and we would get together on Tuesday nights and read our works in progress to one another. And I got to the point where I realized that I was basically doing it for an ego stroke every Tuesday because I didn't take anyone's advice or anything, you know. I just went there and waited to finish my chapter so they all said, you're a real good writer, you know. when we're talking about dialogue that's just so horrible that you can't even, you know, believe it. We had a guy who stopped coming several years ago, whose dialogue was so bad that when he would read it to us during the meetings, he would mess up the inflection of his own dialogue, you know? So the guy would, you know, the guy would be supposed to say, you know, here comes those bastards on their horses, you know, and he'd read it and he's like, here come those bastards on their horses.
It'd be funny if, like, if everything sounded like a question.
Yeah,
here come those bastards, like, on their horses.
Dude, do you even hear, you know, what you're saying? And I, you know, I tell that story to get to this point. Hearing what you're saying as an author, as you're writing dialogue, it is absolutely essential that you hear in your head exactly how you want it to sound and then transfer that to your typed words. Because if you can hear it, chances are your reader is going to be able to hear it. And that's going to make it so much more enriching to them. Mm-hmm. If, you know, you've written it in that way that it sounds like people talking.
Right.
You know,
I mean, that's such a good point, because when we're talking about writing in general and writing dialogue specifically, it's one of those things where you develop over time, and with practice and effort, you develop an inner ear.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That I believe Scott coined the phrase like an ear clunk. Like if your nose as you're reading along, even if you're reading silently, you read through your manuscript and it's, or even as you're writing, and clunk, you know, it's like somebody hitting a flat note on the piano during a performance. Like, oh, even if you don't know anything about music, you know that was the wrong note.
Right.
And the thing about, and readers are a lot savvier than a lot of writers give them credit for. They may not know why they don't like that book.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll say, I don't like that book.
Right.
And it could be that's just the ear clunk. It's just hard to read. You don't want the reader to feel like they're working while they're reading your book. If it becomes a chore, then you've got some work to do.
You know?
I can't remember who said it, but there was a quote, and I should have looked this up, but it's hard writing makes for easy reading.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing this. And again, I apologize. I don't remember who said it, but that is so true.
I think it was me.
I think as S.J. Varango once said, oh, what a coincidence, he's on the show. But you know, I mean, that is so true. That is so true. And it really does show. Well, this, I guess, post concludes. I don't know. We'll have to tune in next time to see if we actually dredge up enough stuff to talk about dialogue again.
I'll tell you one thing. I can think of a handful more examples that would be illuminating. So maybe we can do it again. We'll see.
We might squeeze that turn up a little more. Thanks, everybody, tuning in. We really appreciate you supporting the show. We have a growing backlog now of episodes. So if you haven't listened to those, in particular, our interview with J.A. Jantz, which is our previous episode, pop on over there. She has some really interesting, great things to say. And give us a shout. If there's somebody you would like to hear from, please give us a shout. Let us know, and we'll do what we can to get him on.
I'm hoping one day we get Stephen King, and I'm going to ask him if he said that the road to hell was paved with adverbs. And if he has the wherewithal to say, no, I actually said asphalt, I will write him a check for $1 million. It'll bounce.
I thought you were going to say something else.
Nope. Thought it, but nope.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day.
Bye.